Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 19th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in studio, of course, Mike Robinson, and we will be joined by Patrick Henningsen. Mike and Patrick recently visited the Grenville Tower area and some amazing reports from local people. More on that in a minute. And we also have a guest appearance by Gilad Atzmon, who's going to be talking about why he has been banned. Well, let's start off with the subject of, in fact, the NHS, because, of course, although the government says it is protecting the NHS, evidence easily accessible is that privatisation of the NHS is taking place. Mm. But let's come in on the subject of memory. And thank you very much to our viewer who sent this document. It's Camden and Islington NHS Foundation Trust, and it says, getting help for forgetfulness. It then adds that forgetfulness is common, particularly as we get older. Well, that's certainly true. Often this is nothing to worry about. However, forgetfulness that interferes with your daily life is not a normal part of getting older. So this is all very genteel, measured stuff. I decided to follow it through a little bit more. Where has this come from? What's it about? So let's bring in this one. And I noticed that in the recommended organisations, we had Admiral Nursing. I thought that looked particularly interesting. I didn't recognise it. So I followed through that link that's being provided by the NHS. That brought us into Dementia UK. Now, I found this interesting that the initial brochure is simply saying, well, a little bit of forgetfulness as you get older is fine. If it interferes with your daily life, yes, maybe you've got a little bit of a problem. You can always speak to your GP about that. But behind it, we've got an organisation who is interested in dementia. And in fact, they're interested in providing dementia nurses. This is Admiral Nursing. And of course, we've got a limited company backing up this charity, providing the service. So if you were cynical, you could say, well, actually, this is about money. Mm. We had a look at some of the individuals involved, and this lady caught my eye, Lady Barbara Judge, one of the trustees, experienced international corporate lawyer with significant experience as a senior executive, chairman and non-executive director in the private and public health sectors. First woman chairman of the Institute of Directors, worked in US, Hong Kong and the UK. Also, it says here, chairman of the UK Pension Protection Fund, and Deputy Chairman of the TEPCO Nuclear Reform Monitoring Committee. So this is quite a lady, Mike. In fact, she's recently left that UK Pension Protection Fund. But interesting, you're working on one hand with a Pension Protection Fund and with people getting near the end of their life in another role. I'm not sure I have a comfortable feeling about that. But if we follow her through, it gets more interesting because this is TEPCO. This is taking us to part of the Tokyo Electronic Power Company holding, and this is into nuclear safety. So this lady's got many talents. And if we bring in this part, which is a short summary of her CV, we find that in 1978, she starts off with a large American law firm. But by 1980, a mere 2 years later, she's appointed by the president as commissioner of the US Securities and Exchange Commission. How do you do that?
Not sure, but I don't see any healthcare in her career at all.
No, it's fascinating. She then jumps on through a lot of money work, but 1994 to 2009, she's director and subsequently deputy chairman of Friends Provident PLC. And in that same period, she also becomes director of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. So that is really an amazing career progression. But she's now working to help people with their memory.
So we've got people with deep into private interests circling the National Health Service at the moment. So Might not come as a surprise then that transformation is all is about what it's about. We've got the local partnership. This is Sustainability and Transformation Partnerships of the NHS, and the £325 million it has been announced is going to be invested in NHS transformation projects. We don't quite know what the NHS is being transformed into. We believe it's being transformed into something which is ready for privatisation. The government has continues to deny that, but we, as a matter of course, don't believe them. So this is Jeremy Hunt and also NHS England Chief Executive Simon Stephen have announced this £325 million capital investment for local projects that are going to help the NHS modernise and transform care for patients. And it all sounds very good. In Greater Manchester, hospitals will deliver significant improvements in urgent and emergency care by concentrating services in four hub sites across the city. It's expected to save around 300 lives each year in general surgery alone. In Bedfordshire, local doctors and nurses are developing a primary care hub on the site of Bedford Hospital, which is expected to improve access to same-day appointments for around 50,000 patients and reduce the number of patients attending the hospital's A&E department. In Derbyshire, the Urgent Care Village will be created at the Royal Derby with GP services, a frailty clinic, mental health services to ensure patients receive the right care and the right in the right place at the right time. So what do you think?
It's privatisation. It's being clustered around the NHS, a little bit done at a time. It's all about collaboration, hubs, networking, linking, partnership. But what it really is privatisation.
Right. Well, it's actually even more interesting than that. Here's what Jeremy Hunt said quickly. He said this funding will support strong local plans to help the NHS modernise and transform care for patients. In fact, what they're talking about in amongst all these projects is the merger of the NHS and local authorities, effectively in some departments. So why would you have close collaboration and close merger between NHS functions and local authority functions?
Because that will link you in with everything to do with social services as well, and therefore you're going to effectively be captive in a net. The state will operate a net around each individual.
Absolutely, and it goes even further than that too, because let's have a look at one of their examples. Nottinghamshire turning ambitious IT plans into reality. So this is one of these projects. What are they talking about? Data sharing. Qualms about sharing is what they say on here. We have a portal that is capable of bringing data from different health and care systems to support new ways of working as joint assessment. There has been a lot of emphasis on improving data quality and the implementation of summary care records. To this end, Connected Nottinghamshire is using the Medical Interoperability Gateway to share patient data regardless of the clinical system used. The MIG was first implemented in Greater Nottingham and has since been rolled out across all GP practices within Nottingham and Nottinghamshire STP. That's the Strategic Partnerships footprint. And it supports safer prescribing, apparently, improved diagnosis, and a patient's full history is accessible. But who's it accessible to?
Private corporations, ultimately. Mike.
And the local authority.
Yeah.
And that is of concern.
Indeed.
Okay, let's move on. Now we have Gilad Atzmon with us. Gilad, welcome to the programme.
I'm delighted to be with you once
okay,
again.
Okay, so Gilad, you were supposed to be performing at the Vienna Jazz Festival, but that apparently is not going to happen.
No, it didn't happen. I was supposed to play with the World Peace Trio, with a Jordanian-Palestinian oud player and the ambassador of Indonesian music, Dwiki Darmawan on piano and Kamal Musalem on the oud. And a few days before the festival, we learned from the head of the festival, Fritz Storm, that he was approached by the city council, by the mayor office, who are the biggest funders of the festival, and I had to be removed for the program. I approached the festival through a lawyer, and they made it very clear to them that unless they bring, they present the reasoning, because my record is 100% clean. I've never been accused by any law enforcement authority of, I've never been questioned about anything I have written or said. And I'm teaching in Germany and in Austria. Once he realized that he gets into trouble and he has to justify his act, he just removed the band. And the argument was that we didn't sell enough tickets. We checked with the venue, and the venue told us that the gig was destined to sell out. So we were actually we did sell tickets. What is fascinating here is that we start to see more and more proxy mercenaries that are operating for the Israeli lobby, for the Zionist lobby, for the Jewish lobby. This is one case, the mayor of Vienna or his office, I don't know exactly. But we saw exactly a similar situation a few days ago in Miami. The mayor of a Miami banned kids from performing with Roger Waters. Once again, Roger Waters is a supporter of Palestine. He criticized Israeli apartheid and so on and so on. And it was a mayor of Miami that was used to inflict a penalty on him. And what happened with me in Vienna, instead of doing a concert that was a completely peaceful and non-political event, I ended up giving a talk in the Austrian Arabic Institute about my views, about my politics, about Israel, about some aspect of Jewish power that I found dangerous. So the attempt to silence me backfired, but we are really getting now to a point where freedom of speech is a nostalgic adventure. It is wiped out.
Absolutely. Any thoughts?
I think we are seeing this coming in everywhere. In a moment, we're going to be talking about Grenfell Tower, the fire, and subsequent events around that fire. But of course, one of the things that local people are talking about is if they say the wrong things, they're being silenced. Mm. So,
by the way, this is very interesting because one of the reasons to expel me from the festival is what I said about Grenfell Tower. And what I said is very similar to actually what David Scott is saying. I argue that the regulation, we become hostages of regulation. Now, I define this culture of regulation, regulations and commandments as Jerusalem. I argue that this is exactly the difference between Jerusalem and Athens. We are probably will talk about it later today with David. But the whole issue of Jerusalem is in Jerusalem. We have commandments. We have rules to follow. They tell us what clothing we are putting. And if you are putting the right clothing, everything is kosher, regardless of the fact that they are flammable. Athens is where we think. So I blamed Grenfell disaster on Jerusalem culture that is now beyond dominant in our society. And I guess, and I, by the way, I don't say that Jerusalem is Judaism. You know, the church can be Jerusalemite. Tony Blair is a Jerusalemite. Theresa May is a Jerusalemite. Trump is definitely a Jerusalemite and so on and so on. But some Jews, I guess, were offended by what I said. And I think that it's very important to point at it.
Yeah. Okay, look, Gilad, thank you very much. And as you mentioned there, you are going to be doing something later with David Scott. We're going to pre-record that and put that out very shortly. So thank you, Gilad, for joining us. And it brings us very nicely into Grenfell Tower. And welcome Patrick to the program. Thanks for joining us, Patrick.
Great to be with you guys.
So, Patrick, as we were walking around on the way to the tower, we see lots of graffiti on the streets. You took this image which I thought was the ultimate irony.
This was incredible. This is just on Bramley Road, opposite Latimer Road Station. And you see these signs up at a number of building sites around the country. I just thought it was ironic that this sign is emblazoned across the wall of a barrier protecting a building which is under construction right in the shadow of Grenfell Tower. And as you can see, consider construction, secure everyone's safety, improving the image of construction. And there you have all the missing people. The dead from the tower there. You couldn't get a more ironic photograph than that.
Indeed. Now, just before we move on to what the BBC's up to here, just make the point, Patrick, that a number of people told us while we were there that the pictures of the missing are already starting to be removed. Go ahead.
No, they're everywhere. If you from Notting Hill Portobello area, if you walk towards Latimer Road, it's about a mile and a half. You'll see these images everywhere on lampposts, and it's clustered around under the Westway near Latimer Road Station, especially. And these are memorials more than anything. I think it's symbolic. I think there's a kind of a cathartic experience for residents to have that there. I do think it helps people remember people who they've lost, friends. Family members in some cases. So I think it is very important, and I think it should be up to the residents whether these types of memorials should be removed and not the council. I think that's very important, but I have a sneaky suspicion that it's the authorities who want to determine that rather than the people who actually live in that community.
Yes. Well, yesterday the BBC published this. Now, this is one of their reality check articles. And so they've waded into this into the discussion of what has happened to the donations given by the public following the Grenfell disaster. I say this is one of the reality check articles, which, if you remember, is the BBC's so-called anti-fake news fact-checking service. So I'm just going to run through a couple of the things they say in this, because they've done the reality check, and we've got to assume it's the BBC. The facts are correct. The numbers don't add up. Brian and Pat, survivors and relatives of those who died in the fire at Grenfell Tower last month, they say, have so far received only a small fraction of the cash and items donated by members of the public. It was 2 days after the Grenfell Tower fire that mountains of donations sat in car parks, basketball courts, and by the side of the road. The now infamous and black high-rise block loomed nearby. From clothes to baby milk, bedding to bottled water, the huge quantity of donations was the enduring positive image in the week of tragedy, which shook the country in so many ways. And they say that in total, more than 170 tons of items were donated. Some of those donations through the Red Cross have now been moved to a warehouse in Cheshire, Patrick, in Cheshire. Yeah. And so this apparently is the Red Cross's northern sorting office, which they say is for the Grenfell appeal. The article says that so far 100 giant cardboard containers full of donations have been moved there. An estimated 174 tons of items were donated. 10 tons have or will soon be made available to the former residents of Grenfell Tower. Well, Patrick, this was the image you took from inside the support centre. And mm-hmm. I didn't see, or I don't think you saw, 10 tons of items being made available to former residents?
No. I mean, it's kind of a skeleton operation inside. This is the center that sprung up first to provide support and aid to the residents. This is run by all the various authorities. And you walk in, and it has the atmosphere of a trade show. When you walk in, the first thing you see on the left, the Red Cross have a stand there, complete with the pop-up banners and the table and the gentlemen and ladies with the lanyards around their neck and the branded uniforms and so forth. And so then you move on to the NHS mental health table for those who have mental health and all the NHS literature, and then on to the NHS medical. There is supplies available, but they're mostly in the form of canned goods, this canned food, and there's lots of bottled water, which has been donated as well. And some of the residents are taking advantage of this and trying to get some of these items in order to use as subsistence, and also some of them are available for volunteers who are distributing them on the street as well. What struck me when you walk in this center is there are no victims or residents. There's a few people in there, maybe a few victims or a few residents, but on the whole, it's empty. There are more key workers outnumber, or volunteers or whatever they are, outnumber the actual residents there by, I don't know, a huge ratio. So there's only a handful, but there's tons and tons of people with lanyards around their necks, and you have to get the right colored wristband in order to go in as well. I don't know what sort of aid that center, that operation's actually delivering to people on the ground. I would suspect it's very minimal compared to the actual scale of the what's out there. You have to remember, we're talking about not just the people in Grenfell Tower who have survived, but hundreds, possibly thousands of residents who have been also affected directly by this event.
Absolutely. So let's get back to the BBC article then. They say 10 tons have or will soon be made available. They say 62 tons of donations are being sold in British Red Cross shops. So we've now got official confirmation from the BBC Reality Check that that's what's going on. The proceeds are going apparently to the Grenfell Fund. 15 tons are being sold to textile recycling companies. 87 tons are still to be sorted. Now, that's according to the Red Cross. On top of that, there have been cash donations of £20 million. £5.5 million has come through the London Community Foundation, the Evening Standard Dispossessed Fund, £5.1 million through the Kensington and Chelsea Foundation, £4.7 million through the Red Cross, £4 million, which were individual appeals through various crowdfunding sites, 500,000 from four Muslim charities. The total collected £20 million, and the total given out so far, Patrick, £800,000, and that is £215,000 to Grenfell Muslim Response, £220,000 to the local community foundation, £180,000 to the Kensington Chelsea Foundation, by the Kensington Chelsea Foundation, sorry, 158 by the London Emergency Trust, 158,000 that is. The money, Patrick, has got to be probably the biggest problem we have here, isn't it? Because we already heard residents describing how some people were getting money, other people weren't, and perhaps this is going to be used as a mechanism for breaking up the solidarity that there is within that community.
Sure, I think it already is. That is already happening. There's two reasons why the money wouldn't get distributed evenly. One is just the bureaucracy is inefficient and unable to do that. Period. So you have £20 million raised, and instead of going directly to the residents and those affected, it's being channeled through other charities. So another layer of bureaucracy with yet more administrative costs. And so how much of that, which has been dispersed so far, £800,000, if you divide that up amongst the number of survivors, we're told from Grenfell Tower, that might be approximately £36,000 per head. And if we go and speak to all those 200-odd people, survivors from the tower, how many of them have received the £36,000 per head? If you had divided that squarely, I would say very few, if any, have received that. So what are we looking at here? The charity boondoggle, which exists in the 21st century, which is a massive industry on its own.
And while the official response is pretty lackluster, the community response is as good as it can possibly be, in fact.
Sure. So we went down to visit the community response center. This is down in Acklam Village, just off Portobello Market. You can go down there and you can, donate items and so forth. And so what they've done there is they've just been doing that from day one. That's run by a gentleman named Niles, who's done an extraordinary job of bringing together community volunteers. And then people can come and drop in almost 24 hours a day. to get whatever they need. And I even think that they're arranging to have things brought to people who might not be able to make it down to that particular hub. So they're doing that off completely off their own backs, on their own steam. This is not a multinational charity. This is just the residents coming together. And there's only three requirements, I'm told, by the gentleman who's organizing this, Niles. He said they have to be committed. They have to be sensitive to the trauma that people are going through, who've went through this. And, they just basically have to show up and want to help. That's it. So no qualifications, no training, no sort of bureaucratic red tape. And so this is the community responding on a grassroots level. It's absolutely amazing what they've done in only a few weeks. And in fact, one gentleman from the Red Cross remarked to him, who worked in Sierra Leone, he said, "You guys have done more in 2 weeks than the International Red Cross did in Sierra Leone in 6 months." And that should put things in perspective.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, the police operation to recover human remains continues. The police saying that officers are moving one flat at a time through the building on their hands and knees using small trowels and shovels, removing debris and sieving the debris through a mesh 6 millimeters in size. This, they say, is so that they can pick up any identifiable part of a human body. All debris is being packaged and labelled. And then they move on to the next flat. The speed of their operation, they say, is determined by the fact that they have to pay attention to weather conditions, that they have to go up and down 23 flights of stairs. And what you're seeing on screen at the moment is a still from a video that the Metropolitan Police released, where in this shot you see two Met Police guys in hazmat suits and breathing apparatus. And the guy on the right there, and I really thought this was despicable under the circumstances, he's standing there, breathing heavily and pretending to be out of breath. Now, I'm not going to underestimate the effort it takes to move up and down that building. What they're saying is that they have to work in 3-hour shifts, and if it gets too hot and they're getting dehydrated, they've got to work in shorter shifts, and therefore they're traveling up and down the stairs a lot. But to my mind, bearing in mind the human tragedy in this whole thing, for them to make a big deal of the fact that they have to walk up and down these stairs, these are supposed to be fit police officers, I thought that was pretty despicable. But they're using this as an excuse to apologise for the length of time that it's taking them to get through this job. And as far as I'm concerned, Brian, if you want to do the job in less time, get more people on it.
Well, it is interesting. What I pick up from that is of course, both these men are wearing professional respirators, so they are filtering the air. We know that there's been an asbestos risk, which I think you are going to mention, but so they're in full breathing a respirator they've got on. If there's asbestos around, you don't particularly want to have bare skin on it, because at the end of the day those fibers are going to be on the suits they're wearing themselves. You don't want it on the skin. There's something rather odd about this. And the other thing is there's no windows. So the moment you get up a bit, a few stories, there's going to be quite a breeze blowing through that building.
That's absolutely true. And that is a very good point. And let's just come on to the air quality then, because, of course, the government saying that the air quality in the local area is absolutely fine, no problems with it. But as you've just said, there are no windows in the building, and therefore there's nothing to prevent debris being ejected out of the building by the breeze. So the government has produced its air quality document and statistics, and here's the front page of it showing where they have the various air quality monitoring stations of various types and environmental monitoring following the Grenfell Tower fire, a data update. And Patrick, no surprise that what they're saying is that everything's green, everything's fine, no problems. And if we look at the asbestos monitoring, no asbestos detected on the streets at all. I find this fairly unlikely.
Well, the amount of asbestos in the building and the fact that it's still blowing, and people have to remember Grenfell Tower, and we'll probably look at a shot of that, or there we have a shot of that right now. The building's open, so when the winds are blowing strong through the windows and right out the other side. And residents are telling us debris is blowing out of the buildings today, a month after this fire. So we look at any other construction project around the country, and there's scaffolding put up around buildings with an apron around. And so you could easily build scaffolding up in a very short period of time, maybe a week or two, and then it would be a full apron around the building, and that will keep toxic asbestos fibers, cyanide, and also the remains of the victims are blowing out into the community. So I don't understand how they couldn't have secured the exterior of this building in some sort of cordon sanitaire using scaffolding and aprons like they do on any construction site. That to me is the most shocking thing. It's almost like they're trying to intentionally demoralize the community and the country by having us look at it constantly 24 hours a day. But not only that, this is a massive health risk to many people's analysis. So, I mean, this is a legitimate question to ask here. Why has the building not been secured? Why is the remains of people and toxic material and who knows what else allowed to blow it over the and into the surrounding community in West London? This is an important question.
So as a sanity check, purely as a sanity check, Patrick, I asked David Scott, a structural engineer, what his view of this was. Could it be, for example, that the authorities considered the building to be unsafe and therefore there may be a wind, if you were to produce a wind resistance of that type, that it could be structurally a bad thing to do? And his response was absolutely not. There would be no... that would not be a consideration. So that's not the consideration. I think you've hit the nail on the head. Now, we'll move on a little bit here. But before we come on to a little bit more of this, let's just let everybody know that this weekend, on Saturday, the 22nd of July, 2017, beginning at 12 in the afternoon and finishing at 5 p.m. in the Maxilla Social Club, which is the 2 Maxilla Walk, admission is free. The title of the presentations is Grenfell Facing the Hard Questions. And this is going to be, Patrick, an event by the local community, for the local community. We're going to have a couple of UK column speakers at it, but it's for the local community with local speakers.
That's right. And this is just going to be under the Westway flyover. The nearest tube is Latimer Road. And this is a free event. And so everyone is welcome, residents, volunteers, concerned citizens, friends of Grenfell. Everybody is welcome. And I think the object, from what I'm told about this event, is going to be in order to educate people, to answer questions that aren't being asked in the mainstream and that are not being really fielded by authorities at the moment. That's the purpose of this event, and hopefully it will be able to empower some of the residents that quite frankly are feeling a little bit helpless right now on certain levels, certain people are, and hopefully this event can address some of those needs.
Now, Patrick, as we walked around the tower, we discovered that it is impossible to see the work that is being done at the base of the tower by various people because we've got these large barriers everywhere. Now we can see that there is a crane in there at the moment, but we don't actually know what's going on. And in fact, if you do get to look over the top of this particular barrier, all you see is another barrier.
Yeah, so you could look at this two ways. You could say this is what we're looking at here in this footage. You know, this is a crime scene. So, you know, barriers have been placed around the perimeter of what could be a crime scene. You could look at it that way, certainly, but they definitely are discouraging locals or any passersby from having any view of what's going on the ground level. However, if we pivot it around, I'll throw that back to you, Mike.
I was just going to say that we did actually manage to find one place where we could see something of what was remaining at the base of the tower. We still couldn't get to see what operations were going on there. This was a place where the recovery operation wasn't active, but we can see some of the debris that's still left.
So here's quite a bit of debris, pretty much everything that's fallen down during the fire, and some things that have, you know, fallen down since, possibly when, you know, after windows have been cleared or whatever. But this is a children's playground here, along the, base, on the Latimer Road side. But you can, this is just a small sample of what you'll see, all around the site. And so we also see that certain things have been placed in piles as well, that there's been some sorting has taken place, as well. So, but again, you have potentially toxic material just laying out in the open. If you accept the fact that this building and many like it are laden with asbestos and that this thing went up like a match, so what you have down there is potentially hazardous material. So, you know, it's pretty amazing that it's being handled, in such a possibly in a casual way or mishandled, possibly. Certainly these are legitimate questions to ask at this point.
Can I just add for that? And I think I'm correct, in saying that, of course, a building such as, Grenfell Tower would have had an asbestos survey. That would have been a risk analysis, on asbestos. Carried out, and the details of the asbestos in the building would be in an asbestos register, and that is a key document which should have been held both by the local authority and the management organisation for Grenfell Tower. So there should be no uncertainty about the amount of asbestos in the building, because the quantity and the location of that asbestos is required to be logged in a register by law.
But Patrick, the community, this was on the way to the tower, and the heart there with the text through it. The text says community, because they're recognizing they've got to stick together. But not so keen to encourage the press.
No. So here, this is outside one of the Methodist Church there on the back side of the tower, opposite the Latimer Road station, and this is taped down, displayed here on the pavement. Look, it says no press in this area, and so that's 20 or 30 feet, half moon circumference from the entrance of the church, where there's a massive a memorial there for victims and candles and all sorts of mementos. So you can see that this is a message which is posted for the mainstream media, clearly. And the level of distrust in the mainstream media is at an all-time high. In this community, I would say it's yeah. I mean, trust is at an all-time low, let's put it that way. Yeah. So, but we were received very well because we were independent. I think people recognize that we are not there to protect the TMO or to protect the government, which I think a lot of the mainstream media outlets, that's their first job really, is to protect the establishment, because in fact they are part of the establishment, and so hence the high levels of distrust amongst people in West London. But this is a very clued up, very politically aware community in West London, and I think the establishment might have underestimated them. And yes, they are very keen to stick together on so many of these important issues. So I was really impressed with the level of activity and the common sense street smarts of a lot of people who live in this part of London is just inspirational, to say the least.
And a very creative community with lots of artwork clearly being done very quickly.
Yeah, this is from one of the children, I think, in one of the memorials there. This one's just perpendicular along the back alley next to Latimer Road Station there. There's a long row of kind of shrines to victims, and this was a particularly striking oil painting here. It says class war, and we don't use that term lightly in this situation, because a lot of people, quite frankly, they're looking at it in this perspective, and I think they do have a legitimate point here, because Grenfell Tower does symbolize in so many ways the sort of leaving behind of low-income people in society, and so, you know, housing them in a building that was a death trap and then making money all along the process of doing that. So this embodies all of these concerns, this tragedy.
Absolutely. So, as you say, class war is the label on the picture. Well, I've got to say a huge thank you to the local person who sent this document through to me. This was the Notting Barn South draft final master plan report. So they had a master plan for this whole area. They have a master plan for this whole area. And you've got to wonder how much of the reaction from the authorities to what happened here is them trying, well, first of all, to cover their own backs, but also trying to make sure that whatever they do fits in with this master plan. You know, they have maps for the regeneration. They're looking at nice pictures of the thing. Brian, the first thing that struck me from this document, I haven't read it in detail yet, but some phrases from it absolutely jumped out of the page at me. The first one was, socially, the area could be transformed in tandem with physical change.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, that makes it clear what their agenda is here.
Well, I look at this with the hindsight of what took place in regeneration in Plymouth, going back to sort of about 2004, 2005, where you had government plans for regeneration, a lot of money coming in under Objective 1. That money came into the city. It was not properly accounted for. You started to see fraud and corruption and intense greed for developers to get their hands on deprived areas. Now, some of the areas may well have been deprived, but they had very good and well-established communities in them where basically there were happy families living maybe in slightly poor conditions, but they had their pride. And what you would read in documents is that these people are to be, for example, decanted. This was a common phrase. They're to be moved out, decanted from their area. Not to worry, you can come back when we've done the transformation. But when the area was transformed, of course, the properties were too expensive for ordinary people to come back.
Well, exactly. If you transform the area into that, first of all, there isn't the density of housing there, and the values of the property prices of these are going to be much higher. What else was said in this? A health hub, Brian, for North Kensington that could become a one-stop shop for well-being. Yep. And then we have that well-being word once again.
Yeah, and this is linking together all of the facilities, the NHS, local mental health services, local GP services, so that once you touch it, you're not seen by your own personal private GP. All of your medical information is going to be available, as you say, to the local authority, who by this stage will control everything, including your housing.
Yes, and specifically with regard to Grenfell Tower in this document, it says, we consider that the appearance of this building and the way in which it meets the ground blights much of the area east of Latimer Road Station. It also provides no outdoor space for residents and is likely to be of a type of construction that is hard to adapt. It does contain 120 homes. On balance, our preferred approach is to assume demolition. And as we showed right at the very beginning of this, of course, there was at one point a tender for a contract to demolish the building. But Patrick, we have to say that people are living in poor conditions there in many cases, and some of the houses, some of the accommodation, particularly cramped. You know, how on earth can people in the local area, they do need to have their properties refreshed at the very least, but that can't happen while there is this level of distrust and while there is clear corruption within the local authority and the various other bodies.
I think the level of corruption between government, local government agencies, property developers, and other government-related agencies is so deep and so institutional and is now decades in the making. In South London, there was just to give you a quick example, in Tulse Hill, there was a council estate called Cressingham Gardens, and this was scheduled for demolition, and 1,500 people lived on this particular estate, and this was a thriving community. We're talking generational community. There was no reason to demolish Cressingham Gardens other than to replace it with more expensive, possibly more valuable property in the overall process of gentrifying sort of Brixton, Tulse Hill, and this area. They were going to uproot that community completely, and they promised to relocate them, and like exactly what you and Brian have just outlined, promised them an opportunity to get into the new housing situation and so forth. But that's it's been proven time and time again that that's not exactly what happens. So wiping out the community, this is what this is about. It's about breaking up the community, because the most valuable thing, if you talk to residents in South London, in West London, all over, real established communities, that community is the most important thing in their life. Their friends, their family. This is more important than anything. And to destroy this is really to destroy the lives of all these people, and it's decimating the culture. This is also part of the agenda. That's what we've seen all across the board in every single one of these instances. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. That's great that you brought up the master plan for the Crossrail project there for this Notting Barns, this new concept of a location. And that includes the demolition of Grenfell Tower. It's right there in print. You can see this has been on the cards for a very long time. We're not saying that that had anything to do with the fire. But what we are saying is that the powers that be already have made up their mind what was going to happen to that community.
Can I just add into that? I've got the words on the screen to my right here. I've got the words of a resident from Devonport in Plymouth when their regeneration program was... this is comment on their regeneration program, so it's subsequent comment. And the person says there will be lots of cups of tea and coffee on the go, and they even got the children involved with workshops. And then it says, looking back with a different head, I think it was a bit useless as they had their plans anyway, and it didn't really matter what we said. So that was looking back with hindsight. Somebody in the community in Devonport in Plymouth said, well, there was a lot of cups of tea and talk at the time, but actually they had their plans, and those plans were going to be forced through. And this has been the regeneration pattern across the country in many of the major cities, whether it's Sheffield or Glasgow or Newcastle, inner city, London, Bristol, exactly the same government policy to change communities and the way people live.
And Patrick, just to finish on this section, one final point about this community, this particular community, extremely welcoming to people coming in from other countries and people moving into the, it is an incredibly tight community and incredibly welcoming community.
Yeah, this community over the generations has absorbed many different waves of immigrants, many different types of changes, and it's still endured all the way through. Ladbroke Grove and Notting Hill, but especially Ladbroke Grove, is world famous for its contributions to the arts, to music, to culture. And so it is an incredibly special community. I think everybody who lives there understands that. They know it's a special community. Yeah. They really do. They have a really keen sense of identity there, and they're very, very determined to preserve that. And so they feel that any moves on the social engineering side are going to be detrimental to the cohesion of and the fabric of that community. And so they're really banding together. And I think there's a general recognition amongst the community that they're going to resist some of the social engineering agendas that have steamrolled over other boroughs in London and they have decimated communities around this country.
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick. Right, we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll just before we go mention that tonight is the UK Column monthly meeting in the George in Plimpton starting at 7:30 p.m. Do get along to that if you can. And also just briefly to mention that DVDs from Ian Crane's AV8 event in May, which both Brian and Patrick spoke at, are available on the UK Column website now if you want to get hold of them. And they're at a special price, I believe, until August the 1st. Thank you very much, Patrick, for joining us. I think we need to leave it there.
Yes, but a lot more to come on the subject of Grenfell Tower, without a doubt. Okay, that's it. Thank you for joining us. If you're not a subscriber to UK Column, please consider giving us a subscription, because we need your financial support to do what we do. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye.